The Craig Folly Show on Deadline Detroit is made possible in part by Lynette's Shrimp House, located in Highland Park. It's Metro Detroit's premier destination, serving juicy fried shrimp, fish, and wings, alongside soul food sides and new additions to the menu, like turkey tacos and desserts. Located at 13548 Woodward in Highland Park, just north of the Davison, Lynette's is open for takeaway noon to 8 Tuesday and Thursday, noon to 10 p.m. Friday and Saturday, and noon to 5 p.m. on Sunday. Call now. Get some Lynette's. Hey, greetings, everybody. Welcome to the Craig Folly Show on Deadline Detroit. Thank you very much for being with me on this Tuesday. And for many of you in Metro Detroit, you are just now getting your power back on after, in some cases, 5-6 days without electricity after the latest round of storms knocked out power lines all over our region. And yes, it is an inconvenience and it's a pain in the butt to have to deal with this kind of stuff, but there may be more at stake than we realize when it comes to the robustness and integrity of the electrical grid. As we look at the plans that the president has to move towards more electric vehicles and the push the automakers are making towards more electric vehicles, the weak link in this whole system could well be the grid that is owned by independent and monopolistic utilities like DTE and Consumers Energy. Joining me right now to talk more about this is my friend Paul Eisenstein. He is the publisher of thedetroitbureau.com. He also does work for NBC and, of course, a number of other publications out there. But he's a frequent guest on the program. Paul, welcome. And congratulations on getting your power back after 5 days.
Well, hey, it's worse than that. When you add up the two other outages I've had, long-term outages, never mind those 1 and 2 hour things that hit you. I think my power has now been out 15 total days since the end of June. If I go back at the beginning of the year and I add up anything that's more than just a couple of hours, I've probably had more than 20, 25 days since the beginning of the year. When you think about this, this is the sort of outages you would expect from third world countries or countries in the middle of a war. It's not what you expect in a country like the United States. Worse, Craig, it's coming at the most awful time. This is the moment when automakers and the federal and state governments are trying to tell the world, tell American car buyers in particular, that we should be switching to EVs. Oops. I've got to tell you, I have an EV officially on order, and it makes me think twice.
Well, you know, that is something that people don't necessarily consider because, I mean, the advantage to EVs, if all things being equal, is that you charge them up while you're sleeping and basically you have a full tank of fuel every single day that you wake up. But if the grid goes down, if you are without power, then in reality, you are stranded because if the vehicle can't charge, you know, you're not going to be able to take advantage of the advantages that come with them.
Yeah, well, you know, there is the possibility and going forward, you'll be able to go out and hopefully charge up at a public charging station. But a couple of problems there. Number one, you don't know if those public chargers are going to have energy coming to them. And secondly, you do pay a lot more at a public charger than you do overnight, especially if you have one of those interruptible rates that a lot of utilities have been offering for electric vehicles. Overnight is a great way to charge up. They want to sell the power normally overnight because it's excess energy, stuff they continue to produce even though the demand is low. The problem with DTE in particular, from what I have been able to find by doing my research, one of the worst utilities in the entire United States when it comes to being able to consistently provide power is that you just get a little bit worried. You know, you come home from a long trip, you have maybe 10 miles left or 20 miles left in the battery, and you don't know the next day if you're going to be able to charge at home when it comes to summer storms.
Yeah, it's interesting to me, though, that, you know, when we look at the Biden administration and their plans for electrification of the vehicle fleet in this country, discussions about increasing the number of charging stations around the country, the infrastructure improvements they want to make, is there any indication that the utilities themselves are involved in the negotiations as to how this would work? Because, again, the end provider of that electricity is going to have to be the strongest link in that chain.
That's a big issue. Now, we know that the Biden administration has been talking about getting money as part of an infrastructure bill for beefing up utilities. And we do see some utilities around the country really working to try to make sure they provide consistent energy and that they provide more energy for people, not just charging at night, but for chargers, public or otherwise, that will be used during the daytime. DTE talks a lot about electric vehicles. The problem is they in particular just have a very, very bad record for power outages and for uptime. You have some utilities that are great. They're 99.9% of the time they provide energy. Unfortunately, the story is different depending on what part of the country and what utility you're talking about.
Yeah, well, older parts of the country clearly are going to be more at risk for this because, you know, we don't bury power lines up here very often. I guess they're being done in any sort of new developments that are taking place, but we are going to be having problems with this as long as we have overhead lines in a state like this. And the cost to do it, if you listen to what DTE has to say about this, and by the way, if you want to know what they have to say, go to deadlinedetroit.com. We've got their story up there right now about them saying that, frankly, it's billions and billions worth of dollars that they do not want to charge customers to do it. And they also say that burying the lines doesn't necessarily solve the problems here.
Of course they say it because they don't want to admit that they're an incompetent company. And I've got to say, I'm tired of pulling punches about them. This company always tells you about how bad the storms are and everything, but go look at the record. Craig, you should do a show on this. Go look at the outage times for neighboring states like Indiana and Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Illinois. Those states have very much the same sort of situation that we do with heavy storms, sometimes violent storms, with older communities, tree-lined communities, older grids. And my research so far suggests that there's just no comparison. DTE, in an apples-to-apples comparison, can't keep its lines running. I've talked with a couple of utility people, you know, folks that have been brought in from out of state and sometimes from neighboring states like Indiana or Ohio, and they've gotten a look at some of the DTE infrastructure, and they say that it's poorly maintained, it's older than it should be, and it just simply is not comparable to what we see in neighboring states. You know, you go down to Florida, places like that, where you have lots of violent storms, and that doesn't even include hurricanes. And in many cases, you're looking at companies that are 99%+ uptime and very rarely down. And what's notable about those states is in many cases when they have sometimes statewide power outages, they're able to get things restored much faster. My neighborhood went down because there was a tree limb that fell on a branch in somebody's backyard. I was down 5 days, almost to the minute.
Yeah, and again, that response time is unacceptable to anybody that's dealing with it at the time. But, you know, again, if it does indeed threaten this very move that we're trying to make when it comes to our dependence on fossil fuels, you know, it seems that this is the kind of thing that they want to address. Do you see there being any movement or potential, I guess, from the automotive industry to put pressure on companies like DTE to actually do a better job on this?
I've talked with a few executives way up to C-level suite, and they are not happy, particularly the Detroit automakers. Here you have the companies, well, General Motors has increased its investment in electrified and autonomous vehicles from $20 billion as of March 2020. Their new number is $35+ billion. Ford has almost tripled their planned investment, and Stellantis, you know, which of course took over, merged in with Fiat Chrysler, they've gone from essentially no electric vehicles. Their plan is huge. They're going to have 20 some plug-in hybrids for their various brands, not all coming to the U.S. 20 just plug-in hybrids by the end of 23, and a lot more battery electric vehicles. Look, you're going to see an all-electric battery muscle car from the Dodge brand. So these obviously are not just limited to the Detroit or Michigan market, but when you can't even maintain power in your home market. You know, you like to think that the hometown is where you're going to get particularly high support. And frankly, I had a party this weekend out at my cottage, which I had power, thankfully. And two couples in that group were planning to buy EVs. They've had repeated power outages. They've put off buying EVs.
Well, you know, while we're talking weather here, I do want to talk about some of the flooding that we saw in the city of Detroit in particular a couple of months ago, because one of the things, one of the visuals that we saw were lots of cars underwater that were waiting to be delivered, or either waiting for chips or waiting to be delivered to dealerships at that point in time. Yeah. Underwater, huge amounts. It looked like hundreds and hundreds of cars that were there. And that, of course, now looks like it was due to a lack of proper maintenance on the pumping facility that was there and the loss of power to that pumping facility, which is indeed a huge problem. You know, what happens to vehicles like that? Is this just a cost that the car companies have to eat? Because you can't sell those flooded vehicles.
No, There's a limit to how much water a vehicle can take. Once it gets up into the engine compartment or electrical, gets inside fenders and the like, that's it. In fact, they're required under Michigan law and most state laws, plural, that they be declared flood damaged or salvage vehicles. So in some cases, they may be sold, but usually not. Usually they have to be scrapped. And by the way, that's something, if I can take a slight sidestep.
Sure.
People around Michigan, people who are listening to the show, should be very well aware of. In some cases, you get unscrupulous dealers or other folks who will find a way to acquire, say, from a junkyard, a flood-damaged vehicle, and they can move them around the country. And I love the phrase that's used. They title wash them. There are a couple of states that have very poor regulations when a vehicle is brought in from one state to that and then moved to another. And in some cases, the damage, like being salvaged, being damaged in a total collision or a flood, can get literally washed off the title, and then they show up. So when you're buying a used car, it's always good, particularly if you're going through, you know, shade tree garages or individuals, that you have them checked to make sure. Right now, people are desperate. Well, I know you've been looking. People are desperate to find cars. There's not many out there, used or new. And it's a really good idea to have those cars checked out to be sure that you're not getting something that's been moved around from state to state and may be flood damaged.
Yeah. And like I said, that, again, the root of that problem was the failure of the power system going into that actual pumping facility and some deferred maintenance that was done there as well. Again, so if you are an auto company or if you are a citizen reliant on your power company, which, again, non-governmental agency, but they have you, you know, over a barrel because that's where you get your power. What can you do to demand better performance? I mean, because, look, if the shareholders are happy, it seems that the utilities are happy. And that seems to be the only thing that really matters here. You know, they talk a lot about making sure that everybody has clean and efficient energy, but the track record speaks otherwise. Other than raising attention and complaining a lot, I mean, I'm not sure what can be done. The government is not willing to do it in many instances to really clamp down on them.
Well, there's less that the government can do short of passing legislation. The good thing is that Dana Nessel, our attorney general, has been speaking out more actively and starting to demand that companies refund or give credits and so on. But how much power she has is uncertain. I wonder if she's going to try to find some legal avenue to pressure DTE. What concerns me is in a number of states, we're finding out, Michigan is one, Texas is another, that very, very stupid moves were made where money they've indicated was supposed to go into maintenance and repair, and in some cases, full upgrades, has not been the case. Texas was a great example. They tried to say, oh, you know, we had all this green energy, these windmills and the like that didn't work. In fact, that wasn't largely the case. But even when the windmills did stop working, it turned out that was because they cut corners and didn't invest in the very reasonable additional gear that would have prevented some of those wind turbines from failing in extreme cold weather and ice storms. Gee, I don't know about you, but I've certainly noticed that the wind farms that operate in Michigan have operated in the worst blizzards we have. And fact is, most of the power that you get for the manned stations down in Antarctica come from windmills. So they can operate in just about any circumstance as long as you have an atmosphere.
Very true. Well, it's going to be interesting to see whether or not this creates any pressure for them to stabilize the grid, because it has been proven to be vulnerable to a lot of different things. And you know, I mean, we go back to what it was, how many years ago now? 16 years since the big, you know, brownout or blackout, excuse me. And it's like, it seems like we haven't really made any real progress since then. It's been 20 years, actually.
Actually, Craig, if you look, the numbers, for example, that I quoted you, 15 days out just since the end of June. And if you look at the maps of outages that have occurred this year, we're significantly worse than we have been in quite a while. It's going to get worse. We know that global warming is increasing the frequency and intensity of storms. And so we need to have major steps taken. We know from my neighborhood and other people I've talked to, in many cases, DTE has not done maintenance, you know, clearing trees, replacing bad wires, poles, and transformers. I had one outage, which was almost as long, about 3-4 years ago, when transformers blew, and it turned out they had not been replaced or upgraded or in any way worked on in years. This is not unique to Michigan, but it is really bad here.
More pronounced, shall we say.
No, it's bad. It is bad. And I've talked to friends. I have one friend who is a C-suite executive at it's not a DTE competitor. They're another part of the country. They have they work in a very stormy region. They have a very, very low outage situation, and they have a very high repair rate. And we talked, and there are some things DTE does well, but when it comes to maintenance of their facility, they're known among the industry as not doing a very good job.
All right. Well, Paul Eisenstein is my guest. Again, he's the publisher of thedetroitbureau.com. I'm going to keep him for a couple more minutes because there was some pretty big news that broke yesterday, and it has to do with electric vehicles. All right. You know, the darlings of the EV world have been Tesla for quite some time. They have been the standard that everybody else is trying to live up to. But you and I talked about this a couple of years ago, that it's just a matter of time before federal regulators start looking into them. Now, the National Traffic Highway Safety Administration has announced an investigation into Tesla over their quote-unquote autopilot system. They called it that. And gee, who could imagine that if you call a system autopilot, that some drivers might think that they don't need to pay attention to the road. And it looks like the autopilot system has real trouble recognizing emergency vehicles on the side of the road. There have been 11 crashes related to this, and now NHTSA is really starting to take a deeper look under the hood of Tesla here. It seems they have been spared a lot of this for a long time. It seems like that's about to change.
Well, I'll tell you what. We've known for a while, and I've been reporting for more than several years, pretty much since not that long after Autopilot came to the market in mid-2014, that there were issues. We saw the first death back in, it was in Florida in 2016, when a former Navy SEAL named Joshua Brown was using a video device to watch a film or what have you, and his Tesla Model S ran smack into the side of a big semi that was cutting across the highway. If he had been paying attention, he would have been able to, at the very least, mitigate the impact. What turned out, it was not just him not paying attention, but the Tesla system, the sensors, confused the white truck with the very bright, sunny backdrop. And there have been all sorts of problems with this. Altogether, there have been at least 30 separate investigations of crashes involving Tesla running on autopilot, and it's getting worse, better.
But it's this way. I've seen videos on YouTube of people sitting in the back seat of their Tesla while the car is driving down the road. It was not intended to be that.
No.
And it's, I mean, look, it's cool technology. And if it is the kind of thing that helps you avoid an accident, great. But it does not mean you don't have to drive the car. And I'm wondering if NHTSA will look at the name of this.
This is
actually, sit there and say, this is a really stupid idea to call it autopilot because it's not the same as leaving a plane in the air.
Right. In fact, a number of countries like Germany have really come down on Tesla for using that name. I think it may have, and I can't tell you for sure, been forced to change the name in a couple of countries. But if you go to their website, it actually will tell you you cannot drive hands-free. Great. That's a small print in a place that most people don't look.
Of course.
The reality is, right from the beginning, you saw Elon Musk putting out a video with his former wife showing their hands hanging out of the side of the car as they drove off with the earliest version of autopilot. And Musk has basically repeatedly made it sound like that system is capable of fully self-driving. Listen, look at the latest version. What does he call it? Full self-driving, FSD. It's full self-driving, yet their website says you're supposed to have hands-on. Well, that has encouraged people to get out of the driver's seat, to even go in the back seat, to fall asleep, and so on. And I'm surprised they haven't had even more crashes.
Well, I mean, not just that, though. I mean, it seems to me that there's a huge potential liability here. Just because you put something on your website doesn't mean that a jury might not reasonably conclude that you misled your buyers about what this was capable of. Somebody's going to die and their family is going to sue, and it's going to cost them a lot of money.
Yeah, I'm surprised there haven't been more lawsuits. There may be, you know, very often you have cases where people settle out of court. They may never even go to court, go to arbitration and the like, where you never even know what happened. So I really can't tell you whether that's been an issue or not with Tesla at this point. You know, there's been pressure to try to change the arbitration system so things like that go public. And I hope NHTSA will require it. NHTSA has been slowly stepping up requirements for some of these technologies. And there's a lot of them coming to market. You know, you have Super Cruise from GM, which you can drive hands-free in limited circumstances. Ford's about to bring out Blue Cruise, and there's others. But nobody has had this sort of schizophrenic promotion of their technology the way that Tesla has.
But that's the question I wanted to ask you, Paul. You've driven all these vehicles. You've seen this technology up front. You've talked to the engineers about it. Is Tesla's that much more advanced than what GM, Ford, Mercedes, BMW, everybody else, Honda, is putting on vehicles right now? Because, look, there's lane assist departure. You know, there's automatic braking if you're close to an accident. But none of those are ever promoted as being something that replaces the driver behind the wheel.
No, if anything, with the exception of Ford and GM with their two systems, none of them have been promoted as hands-free at all.
But are they equivalent?
Yeah, and GM and Ford are both making it very clear that there are very specific circumstances. Plus, you need to be able, watching the road and ready to take control immediately. One of the things that Tesla has gotten seriously beaten back for is the fact that they have no driver monitoring system. They're just about to start doing that. But the Ford system, Mercedes, GM, of course, they all have various systems, cameras, capacitive sensors in the steering wheel or what have you. And if they see a driver getting distracted, certainly falling asleep, certainly if they were to leave the driver's seat, basically the system shuts down. It'll slow down, issue a warning, and eventually just plain either go to the side of the road or even stop and fire off. So one or two of the systems will actually call for emergency help, assuming that maybe the driver has become incapacitated. Tesla doesn't do that.
And that seems to be a responsible approach to this. And I mean, you know, here's the question, though, that I want to talk about, because you look at the care and the caution that the major automakers are using when it comes to these systems. It almost seems as if their experience in the past with federal regulators has got them to be incredibly cautious about the language they use and the way that they approach these things. And I'm wondering if this is a lesson that Tesla's not going to learn until they get smacked down in some capacity, because it happens to every automaker. Every automaker has been whacked by NHTSA.
Yeah, if you look out there, there was a great Wall Street Journal piece a few weeks ago that talked about how Tesla has violated the rules that every other automaker has learned since Toyota came into the country, which is emphasis on customer service and quality. And Tesla has basically said, we're not worried about quality. You know, if it's a problem, we'll fix it. We're not worried about customer service. You know, they give lip service to it, but they don't really have a great level of customer service. And a lot of critics, Consumer Watchdog just issued a statement saying they're tired of seeing Tesla experiment on its owners. And by the way, you mentioned something. I didn't answer this from before. You said, how do they compare? Well, I find it interesting. First of all, in Europe, Auto, Motor, and Sport, one of the most well-reputed publications, automotive publications, ranked the autopilot system way down on the list. In the U.S., autopilot ranked well behind the GM Super Cruise system by Consumer Reports, which has traditionally been very Tesla friendly. So I think that Tesla's autopilot is starting. People who might have loved it at first are starting to say, wait a second, this isn't as good as we thought.
Yeah, well, like I said, it's going to be interesting to see where this investigation goes, what they discover. And hopefully, like I said, the goal of doing these is to improve the overall safety of vehicles. I mean, NHTSA is not out there looking to score, you know, to get people, but they definitely want you to, you know, keep safety in mind. It's a big deal, and it's actually led to a lot of really, really important changes in vehicles over the years. So NHTSA has a role to play, and I'm sorry, Tesla's going to have to learn to be not just a disruptor, but actually, you know, a good corporate citizen at this point, because this could cost them a lot. Every one of their vehicles has this. Is it something as simple as a software upgrade?
There's a lot of debate over what it's going to take. For one thing, they're really going to have to re-stress to their owners that you have to have hands-on. And you have to be closely monitoring the situation. It is certainly going to require, as far as I'm concerned, putting monitoring systems in going forward so that people will be required to keep eyes out and hands on the wheel. And I don't know what you do about the old vehicles. Yes, they can do software updates, and they've done that. In fact, they've been taking some hits because they, on some models, eliminated the cameras and try to go solely to radar technology for autopilot. And not everybody's convinced that that's going to be safe. In fact, some people are downright worried that it'll be dangerous. I don't have a lot of faith in Tesla. They're very good at their electric drivetrains, but I am not comfortable with a lot of the other things they do. And I agree. I think much like any cell phone company, they experiment on their customers. And I think that is totally inappropriate when it comes to an automobile.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see again where this all leads, and whether or not, you know, Elon Musk and company, you know, can look beyond just their market valuation and figure out that, you know, hey, this could all go away. If a couple of really, really bad incidents and a really bad rating from NHTSA, that stock price may not be what it is right now.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right. Well, we'll have to wrap it up for today with that, Paul. I appreciate your help as always. Again, Paul Eisenstein is the publisher of thedetroitbureau.com. Oh, real quick, though, if you're a fan of Paul and my podcast, well, guess what? The Detroit Bureau has its own podcast out there right now. Give us just real quick. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, we just launched it about a couple weeks ago.
And it's quite good, by the way.
Well, thank you. And instead of this format, which you do so well, which is really a running commentary sort of situation, we decided to go to a scripted, tight, almost to the second, 10 minutes. We open up with a roundup of the breaking news, latest news in the automotive world, and then focus on a top story, individual top story. We have a review and two of the most fun segments. One is a look forward, what's going to come up in the coming week in the auto industry. And then Larry Prince, one of the best auto writers out there, takes a look at the world of automotive history. What happened in the week in the past? So he'll go back as far as the 1890s and talk about some of the earliest automakers, as well as some things that may have happened just a couple of years ago.
Well, I got to say this. I'm a little bit jealous of Larry because, if I'm not mistaken, he's the guy that got to cruise around in the new Grand Wagoneers the other day.
Oh, so did I.
They look pretty cool. We'll talk about those another day because I can't afford one anyway. But that's all right. Paul Eisenstein, thank you very much.
It's great to be with you, Craig.
All right. This is the Craig Folly Show on Deadline Detroit. Looking for the latest news and information about our great city of Detroit? Head to DeadlineDetroit.com for one-stop shopping for the most important stories of the day. Deadline Detroit has some of the best journalists in town, providing original reporting, videos, and podcasts that keep you in the know about everything happening in Detroit. Become a member today, and you'll automatically be entered into a drawing for prizes, including gift cards to some of Detroit's best restaurants. Go to DeadlineDetroit.com/membership. Thanks, everybody, for listening to the Craig Folly Show on Deadline Detroit. I really do appreciate all of your support. Don't forget, if you like this podcast, it's important that you share it, that you rate this podcast, and that, of course, you subscribe to this podcast. It all helps. And the more sponsors we get, the more interviews we can do, the more shows I can put together. And I certainly do want to make sure that you are enjoying what you're listening to. So if you have suggestions, you can reach out to me, thecraigfollyshow@gmail.com. Again, that's thecraigfollyshow@gmail.com. You can get through to me that way. It's very, very easy to do. And you can find me on LinkedIn, on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram, on Snapchat, just about anywhere. In the meantime, I'd love to hear from you. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.